When I'm finished with this conversation with Dr. Satel, I'm going to post a link on my Facebook page to the article that she wrote called Taking on the Scourge of Opioids. It's the best read on the subject I've ever read. Maybe not, maybe not you, but it is me. And it, because she looks more honestly and more closely at the origins, the present state of, and the challenge of solving this opioid crisis, even if we do everything right. So let's bring in Dr. Sally Satel, psychiatrist and resident scholar of the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Satel, good morning and welcome to Nashville's Morning News.
Thanks for having me and thanks for the nice words.
Delighted to have you. You've painted not exactly a rosy picture here. But I appreciate the honesty and I appreciate you clearing up some things. I've had a lot of questions about this that nobody else has answered and you did. But I want to start with the most basic question, and that is, why is this so addictive? What does it do to the brain that makes this so addictive versus other kind of substances that are less addictive?
Well, opioids, you know, they've been around forever, the opium poppy. And we get morphine directly from it, as well as opium. And then we've got the semi-synthetics, which are what most people have heard about, Vicodin, Percocet, hydrocodone, and then the very deadly synthetics like fentanyl and carfentanil. And, you know, they attach to the opioid receptor in the brain. The opioid receptor is distributed pretty much all over the brain, including the respiratory system. So that is why people can overdose and die, because the molecule attached to the respiratory system as well and suppress it.
Why do people keep craving a stronger and stronger or more and more dose? What happens in the brain that causes that to happen?
Right. What happens is people develop tolerance. So, and you're probably familiar with a minor version of this too. If you've taken sleeping pills, if you're not used to taking sleeping pills and then you take one, you know, every night for a few nights, it may work on Monday, but by, you know, Wednesday, that one pill isn't as effective. Even on that micro level, people build up a tolerance, which means they need more and more drug to get the same effect. And that's because the natural response of the brain and, frankly, the body in general is to compensate for the effect of new chemicals that are introduced, new pharmaceuticals. So the tolerance builds up and people chase stronger and stronger doses. And believe it or not, this sounds utterly morbid, but some people actually seek out fentanyl because it's so powerful. It's 50 times as potent as heroin. And if you hit that sweet spot, you know, you get just enough of a dose to have the effect, which is a very, very powerful sense of, you know, warmth.
And then one more milligram and you're dead.
Pleasure. Right. Yeah. And then what? Right. Yeah. Just right over the edge, you can be dead. And naloxone can revive you. You know, Narcan, what EMTs
do. You can die four or five times now if you want to, right?
Well, if they get there fast enough, yeah, they will often have to use several doses, up to sometimes over a dozen. So that's one episode. And then it is not uncommon for the same person and for the EMTs to be back at that same house 3 days later, reviving the same person.
Yeah. I want to quote you. I want to quote you and then ask you to elaborate on some of these quotes. Much of the conventional wisdom surrounding the opioid crisis holds that virtually anyone is at risk for opioid abuse or addiction. You say that's not true.
That is not true. And it's one of the more dangerous myths of the epidemic. The average person who receives a handful of Percocet for a wisdom tooth, now parenthetically, I'll say maybe they didn't even need those Percocet. It could have been extra strength Tylenol, would have worked just as well. But, you know, they get a handful of them. Chances are very high they will take those medications. Frankly, many people will feel sick because it's a common reaction to feel nauseated by opioids if you're naive to them. And that will be it. That'll be the end of it. The problem is that the dentists, and dentists are often implicated often, is that instead of those 2 days' worth of Percocet, you'll get a month's worth of Percocet.
Right.
And what do you do with that? You know, you put it in your medicine chest, and then your teenager's funky friends come over, and it's gone. It ends up basically feeding this whole pool of illicit prescription opioids.
The majority of people who develop problems are not the people to whom it was prescribed, you say.
That's right.
Explaining that right now. Yeah.
Yeah, let me just elaborate a little bit. I'm not saying that there's no one in this universe who's ever received Percocet for a broken leg and then become addicted to it, which is different than dependent on it, because everyone will become a little tolerant and everyone will suffer some kind of withdrawal if they've been on these meds for a while and it's removed. But I mean addicted as in craving it, wanting it to change one's state of mind.
Right.
I'm not saying that no one with a broken leg has ever become addicted, but I am saying the chances are very high that the person who did get a Percocet for a broken leg and become addicted is someone who had a previous problem with struggled with alcohol or drugs in the past or concurrently, or has a problem with depression, anxiety, PTSD, some sort of psychiatric problem. So that's the subset of let's just say legitimate patients become addicted. But the vast majority, right, of abused pills are not even used by patients at all.
I had a really good discussion with somebody the other day, a caller, about this. It's been my belief, just from what I know about addiction treatment, that at some point along the line, the person has to take responsibility for their addiction, not just admitting they've got a problem, but admitting that this is their problem. They're the ones that basically caught. They can't blame it on the doctor or the pharmacist or anything else. If you don't own it, you're probably not going to solve it. Right or wrong about that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this isn't pneumonia where someone gives you a pill. It's not a passive recovery, that kind of thing. You can be in a coma and recover from an infection. You have to be the most active participant in recovery. And I see this every day. I think one of the issues here is that, I have clinical experience, and that does give you a somewhat of a more realistic view of this. I don't know one patient in my clinic who doesn't say that, they were dealing with problems and the way they were dealing with it got away from them. And how else do you get better if the flip side of having a role in creating your problem, as desperate as you feel at the time, is that you can help reverse it.
One more thing, and I'm so sorry we've got so little time, and I want you to come back because this is such an important topic, and it's going to be around for a while, and I really do want to pick your brain on it more. But short-term treatment is practically worthless, and maybe worse than worthless. Long-term treatment is absolutely necessary, but must it necessarily be very expensive?
Short-term treatment, if you mean 5 days in the detox and then on the street, that's useless and possibly dangerous because you've lowered your tolerance. You go out and use what you used before, and that's that. Long-term, believe it or not, there are people who do recover on their own. But if you're going to commit to treatment, it has to be usually a minimum of a year. We have good medications. Not everyone needs the medication, but it should be offered. I'm talking about methadone, buprenorphine, and a blocker called Vivitrol, which comes as a monthly shot. These are all really good medications, but people have to work with it. And the dropout rates, unfortunately, are quite high. Most people it's very common to give a urine test in these programs that they have other drugs in them.
I'm sorry to have to keep cutting you short. Isn't it also true that there's still, even when everything is exactly right and everybody does its thing right and they kick it, the recidivism rate down the line is still there and it's not low, right?
True, but a lot of people don't finish. If you really finish these programs and follow up with the aftercare and have a social network, AA is a good one, but it doesn't have to be an AA type thing. If you follow some pretty obvious steps, because you should have learned them in a good treatment program, you have a good prognosis. You could have a damn good prognosis.
And what would be the average cost of taking a person all the way through from start to finish for a good program, one person, you think?
Well, it depends. If it's a private program, those costs, well over $10,000 to $20,000 a month. If you happen to get in, if you live near a university and can get into, you know, one of their clinics, Yale, you know, BU, I mean, all these places, you're in much better shape. University of Alabama, I mean, that's, you can be in quite good shape. There's a lot of follow-up. They're also doing some research. They really are trying to learn more as well as help people. And there's quite an investment. And I don't think it's
affordable treatment
for the person.
Is affordable treatment relatively easy to find if you live in a fairly good size population?
If you live in a good size, I think, yes, around, you know, within the reach of a university can be.
Nashville, sure. You should be able to find
good,
affordable treatment in Nashville.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Dr. Satel, thank you so much. I do want to talk with you again. I hope we can. So,
okay, good.
Please stand by. I've got your contact information now. I appreciate it. Dr.
Satel,
thank you. And I'm going to post her article on my Facebook page. I would encourage everybody to read it.